On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. We have Representative Adam Neelan on the line, and our first topic is the unemployment claims backlog. The State Department of Workforce Development has processed nearly 4 million claims in 4 months, but still tens of thousands of Wisconsinites are waiting weeks, even months. Democratic lawmakers are looking to change unemployment laws to address the backlog. Have you filed for unemployment since the start of the pandemic? What has your experience been like? What are you seeking from state lawmakers as they consider economic relief bills? How would you prioritize state tax dollars? We're at 800-642-1234. Adam Neelan is a Republican state representative from Pewaukee. He chairs the Assembly Committee on Jobs and the Economy. He's also vice chair of the Joint Committee for Review of Administrative Rules. Representative Neelan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. Happy to be here.
Well, let's first start with unemployment. Earlier this month, Republicans floated the idea of creating a 100% forgivable bridge loan program through the CARES Act money, and residents who are waiting for their unemployment claims would be processed that way. What do you think of this?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you look at this heartbreaking situation where people are trying to afford their mortgage and feed their families and, you know, just get by in this global pandemic right now, I think we need to have all options on the table in terms of how we're helping people. And I think that if you look at the loan process in terms of coming in, you know, providing your social security number, bank routing information, I think that could be a streamlined process. It's able to get money into the hands of people right away. I think it's an idea. I think it's a way that we can use some of that federal dollars that is meant to assist the people of Wisconsin to better help them. So, you know, I think it's a worthy idea that should be discussed and vetted and go through the public hearing process. But it's an idea that I think could help a lot of Wisconsinites.
Governor Evers has said, though, it's risky just to send money out with no real understanding of the adjudication process that DWD goes through. Are you have any concerns about fraud?
Well, I mean, in terms of administering the unemployment insurance claims process, I don't think he has a great track record of the unemployment insurance as well. I mean, I think we saw that he had overpaid over $20 million in benefits in the month of April alone. So, you know, I understand why he'd be concerned about that. I mean, it certainly has happened on his watch, but I think that there is a way to do it that's streamlined, that's effective. And one of the things we need to be able to help Wisconsinites, and, you know, if you look at the process that could be providing loans to people in need, you know, that there is a process of getting that money back or clawing it back if it was due it fraudulently, especially if you have someone's social security number and their bank account number, and, you know, you could put it within their state taxes so we could claw it back through the tax process. So I think there are ways to mitigate those concerns, but, you know, I understand where he's coming from.
Well, last week, Democrats unveiled their own package of 8 bills on looking at unemployment. Several bills would expand eligibility for benefits, reduce work search requirements, and give state workers more discretion to approve claims. How do you look at these bills? Are these steps sound to you?
I think they're worthy to take a look at, certainly. You know, I think one of the problems that we're having in the state of Wisconsin right now is through the administering the unemployment insurance program as is. You know, and I'm not sure that any of those bills go to address some of the problems we have through unemployment insurance, simply making more people eligible for it. You know, while, you know, that is a discussion that, you know, I'm willing to have and that we can take a look at, I think the main issue we have with unemployment insurance right now is an administrative problem, and the fact that so many people out there, so many Wisconsinites who are eligible, currently eligible to receive unemployment insurance benefits, aren't receiving them. And I think we need to fix that backlog. You know, we need to address that issue. If we can simply get the unemployment insurance benefits to the people that are deserving of them and have been waiting for them, that's going to go a long way to helping our workforce and helping recover from this global pandemic. And I'm not sure that that's the direction that we need to be focusing our priorities on.
We're discussing unemployment, the pandemic, state politics with Representative Adam Neelan from Pewaukee. With your insights, what are your top priorities for state lawmakers if they return to Madison this year for votes? What needs to be addressed? What questions do you have for Representative Neelan? What do you want to ask him? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Representative, is there bipartisan agreement to improve the state's unemployment system this year? Do you see where Democrats and Republicans can come together around changes to unemployment?
I do. And I think some of that work has been done in terms of being able to shift an unlimited amount of state employees over to DWD to help process claims, to have the ability to expand hours, have the ability to shift more money from the CARES Act dollars into DWD. I think there has been work done to try to improve the system. You know, if you look at, you know, you hear a lot of criticism about the actual system itself, but a lot of
that states, it's,
you
know, so old.
Right. But a lot of other states, when you look at Iowa, you look at Colorado, a lot of states that are doing some innovative work. I mean, Colorado recently launched a new program allowing callers to have an automated system to talk to a virtual agent to help streamline this process. Well, guess what? They also use COBOL. So a lot of the states that are doing innovative, interesting things to help streamline this process are also using this system that Democrats continue to blame for part of the process. So I think it goes beyond the system. You know, I think this has shined the light on ways that we can try to help and streamline this process and help people to, you know, process the claims quicker. But ultimately, I think a lot of this falls on just a failure to administer the these claims efficiently and properly. And you know, I think in some ways the administration was kind of caught blindsided by this, which is very surprising.
Representative John Nygren tweeted last month that the state could call in the National Guard to help process claims like how Washington State did. What do you think of that approach?
I think that's a good idea. You know, I think that if we're able to get more people to process claims, if we're able to have more hours, if we're able to automate the initial process, I mean, anything we can do to improve or streamline this process to make sure that people are getting the benefits, I mean, it breaks my heart. I mean, hundreds of people contact our office about, you know, waiting, you know, they're waiting 8 to 10 weeks. And, you know, some of these people, I mean, they're trying to pay to keep their mortgage. You know, they're trying to feed their family. I mean, this is an emergency situation. So if we can bring in the National Guard to help streamline this process and help get benefits to people faster, I'd be all for it.
Should state lawmakers increase the state's unemployment payments when the federal government's $600 weekly assistance expires this month?
You know, I think that, you know, we should certainly look at all options in terms of how we can help Wisconsinites. But unfortunately, unlike the federal government, we can't print money. So we have certain limitations and budget constraints, and I'm not sure if it's fiscally feasible to do that, but I certainly think we should take a look, get a better understanding of where our budget's at, look at the numbers and see if there are things we could do to assist or to supplement people's income. But, you know, it's tough when you are operating under budget constraints, as the state of Wisconsin does, opposed to the federal government, who has a lot more ability to put money into the economy.
We have Representative Adam Neelan from the 98th Assembly District, including Pewaukee, parts of Lisbon, half of Waukesha. Do you live in the district? What do you want to ask about? What are your top priorities for state lawmakers if they return to Madison this year? What needs to be addressed? Be part of this at 800-642-1234. The state cap continues in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Republican Representative Adam Neelan of Pewaukee stays with us as we look at the pressing issues Wisconsinites face in the COVID-19 pandemic. We're asking how lawmakers are responding to these challenges. What are the greatest difficulties in your life, in your community, that you want state lawmakers to know about? What questions do you have about how the pandemic and how state authorities are responding? What actions should lawmakers take now? Join in 800-642-1234. And Representative Nealon stays with us for 10 more minutes. Greg from Sheboygan called in but couldn't stay with us, wanted to know whether you think the state opened too soon.
I think that in terms of opening, I think it certainly should be a regional approach. And I do not believe that the state opened too soon in terms of allowing people to get back to work and be able to support their family. I mean, we talked about the unemployment crisis right before this. I mean, I can't imagine what type of crisis we would be in and if we had continued the shutdown for this entire time, you know. But I do think that there is a balance, but we need to protect freedom and we need to protect people's ability to go to work and provide for their family. And I don't think that there was any way that we're going to be able to keep people locked down and not go to people's houses or visit their families. I think that we just need to be able to make sure that our hospitals aren't overrun, that we try to flatten the curve. So I don't believe, you know, in general that we open too soon. I certainly believe in a local approach. And if, you know, Milwaukee County has an approach to it that's different than Waukesha County or that's different than Sheboygan County, then I support that. I think that that is in the best interest of, you know, local governments to put these restrictions on. But at the same time, overall, no, I don't think that we opened too soon.
Well, let's look at mask wearing. In recent weeks, more communities across the state are issuing orders that require people to wear masks in buildings or indoor places. You said last month that wearing masks should be a personal choice. Are you standing by that?
In terms of wearing masks, overall, yes, it is a personal choice. I mean, there are situations where certainly masks would be effective. If you're in a situation where you can't socially distance, if you're inside and talking to somebody face to face, then yeah, to limit spread, then it would be important to wear a mask, you know. But I don't think that all situations are created equally, and that, you know, there are situations where it doesn't make sense to wear a mask. There are certain people that have health limitations that aren't able to wear masks. So I think we need to understand that there are situations where it makes a lot of sense and there are situations where it does not. You know, you look at certain situations where somebody is out walking their dog wearing a mask. I don't understand that, quite frankly. You know, I don't understand why the government would require somebody outside that is not, you know, within 6 feet of somebody to have to wear a mask to leave their house. You know, so I think it should be decided on a case-by-case basis, you know, and that when you are indoors talking to someone face-to-face, it makes a lot of sense. And in a lot of other situations, you know, 99% of the situations you're in your daily life, a mask shouldn't be required.
How would you see mask orders different from, say, the government ordering people not to smoke indoors or perhaps the debate over wearing a seatbelt?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, on a mask situation should be handled through the emergency rulemaking process. It should not be handled by lawmakers creating a law that says, you know, that masks should be worn at certain times. We have a process through this, through the emergency rulemaking process, where the governor can propose rules. Granted, they need to be approved by the Joint Committee on Rules, Administrative Rules, which I do sit on. And we look at different rules that could be beneficial for a certain time period that lapse. You know, it's not like smoking indoors where you have to pass a law so forever that you can't be smoking indoors. Masks, we should not be passing a law forever regarding masks. It should be handled on the rulemaking process. And quite frankly, Governor Evers has not proposed that. you know, and he has not proposed any rules through the emergency rulemaking process at this phase, which, you know, I think is concerning because there are things that we should look at to protect our most vulnerable populations, to look at a plan to open schools and the UW system. So I do think that there is a dramatic difference in how lawmakers approach mask wearing versus things like smoking indoors.
We're discussing state politics with Republican Representative Adam Nealon from Pewaukee and taking your calls at 800-642-1234. You mentioned schools there. Representative, Milwaukee and Madison Public Schools are planning to start the year completely virtual. Other districts are looking at hybrid plans. How do you feel about kids and teachers returning to classrooms this fall?
Yeah, I would be supportive of them returning to classrooms. I think there needs to be, you know, a discussion in terms of how we can best protect both the children and the faculty. But if you look at, you know, overall education, you know, being an essential part of our society, and I think kids do learn better when it comes to being at schools hands-on. I mean, hands-on learning is a big part of our curriculum, and being able to, you know, interact with others, to like learn from a teacher in person, to be part of a school community, I think is vital to the development of children. I certainly understand that there are certain restrictions or requirements or maybe temporary rules that must be put in place to protect the health and safety, you know, of our population. But overall, I think we should be working towards figuring out how to get children back into school.
And that's going to take dollars, though. The amount of cleaning and the reduced classroom size and the student to teacher ratio. How do you do that without additional funding?
Well, I mean, in terms of proposal, you know, we certainly are going to be going into this budget looking at ways to increase education funding. You know, I mean, if there is a proposal, like I alluded to earlier, I mean, if there is an emergency rule that requires funding, I mean, the only way to propose that to get the ball rolling is to have an agency or the administration propose that. And at this point, you know, even being on the Committee on Administrative Rules, I have not heard from the governor's office or any agencies or administration in terms of how we can look at solving this issue. I have sent a letter several months ago to the governor saying, hey, look, I am on board for figuring out how to get schools back open, how to protect our vulnerable population. I mean, what is the funding requirements? I mean, let's figure this out. And I have not heard back.
What kind of statewide order would you consider reasonable at this point?
In terms of education or overall?
Overall, education, you name it. As you vice chair of the legislature's rules committee, which could play a very influential role in allowing, say, future shutdown orders by the governor or stipulations on education.
I truly hope that we do play a role, because we should play a role. And in terms of looking at rules, I'd be all for it. I mean, I am not out there, and Republicans aren't out there saying there should not be any rules. I mean, we need to look at in terms of protecting our vulnerable population, getting people back to school. Are there funding issues? Let's address that. What's our budget like? I mean, we want to be part of this discussion. Unfortunately, when you look at the proposal, it needs to come from the governor to get the ball rolling. And if I was the governor, I'd be calling every member of the committee saying, what are the things we can work on? What are the things we can get done? But I've heard crickets. And when you listen to what the governor says, he says, well, we're probably not going to be able to pass something through the Republican legislature, so I don't see the point. And that, to me, that's a failure of leadership. I mean, just speculating that we can't pass rules is not reason enough not to draft a proposal or to reach out to the other side to say, what can we get done? And I truly want to be part of the solution. And, you know, I've sent a letter requesting, you know, how can we do something to protect the vulnerable populations? How do we get kids back to school?
I want to quickly bring in Pam in Horicon with a question. Hi, Pam.
Sure. I'm curious what the representative has children in public school.
I have three children, a 4-year-old, a 2-year-old, and a 1-year-old, and I send them to the Waukesha Community Technical College Child Development Center. They're not old enough for public school. My oldest will be starting public school 4K this fall. So, yes, she is enrolled in public school this fall.
Really quickly, we talked with Department of Children and Family Secretary Emily Amundson last week, and she urged more funding for child care on top of the $51 million from the CARES Act. What is your response?
Absolutely. I mean, child care is going to be a crisis, no doubt about it. I mean, it is, you know, I just met with the Child Care Administrative Board last week to discuss different ways that we could address this problem. I mean, if you look at all the studies, you know, child's brains are fully developed and formed by the time they're 5 years old. And this needs to be on the forefront of people's minds when they're looking at the recovery, is looking at ways we can improve childcare, improve access to childcare, improve affordability. Certainly vitally important.
Representative Nealon, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Adam Nealon, Republican state representative from Pewaukee, represents Sussex, Pewaukee, and half of Waukesha. Coming up, the State Capitol Report continues with WISP Politics editor J.R. Ross. That's after a news update here on the Ideas Network. We're getting a preview of the August 11th partisan primary election on the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A couple races we're keeping an eye on. There's the 5th Congressional District race in which longtime incumbent Jim Sensenbrenner is not seeking re-election. Two Republican candidates and one Democrat are vying for his seat. Another race that stands out, the 26th State Senate District, with the retirement of longtime State Senator Fred Risser of Madison. 7 candidates in that primary. Do you live in Madison, Green Bay, La Crosse, Muskego, or another community with an open State Senate seat this fall? What issues are important to you? We're at 800-642-1234. J.R. Ross is the editor of WISP Politics. J.R., welcome back to the Ideas Network.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. So how are you seeing the ongoing pandemic affecting campaigns for the August election?
Well, initially, it was a challenge for candidates to get signatures because usually you have this opportunity to go to a large festival or go to the shopping mall on the weekend or just where people gather and or go door to door. That was kind of cut off for people, so they had to get a little more creative in how they did it. So that's unique. Fundraising wise, haven't seen a big dent in the amount of money that they've been able to raise. Money still flows in politics, even in a pandemic. But it's just different because you aren't seeing as many candidates on the doors, which is traditionally at the legislative level, that's how you campaign. You go door to door, you hand out literature, you leave door hangers, you talk to people and engage. That's really a big part of that for the legislative level. And we've seen some of it going on, not a lot. For the presidency, there's one group I know of that is going door to door already in Wisconsin. Actually, it's really in southeastern Wisconsin they're focusing on, but we're just not seeing that big door to door effort yet. And part of it's because people aren't really happy with the idea of somebody knocking their door to have a conversation with what's going on.
They probably won't answer their door. I'm wondering then, how did the candidates get their signatures then?
Well, there were all kinds of ways. They did things like they would have set up a table somewhere and they'd have people there with like masks, you know, so you walk up to the porch, sign and walk away. Or I've seen like they just put out the papers and a couple of signs, hey, come sign this. Also, a big thing was to have people. You could turn in multiple sheets of paper with signatures. So you could have supporters download a sheet of paper, they sign it, and then they mail it into you. And then you collect all these dozens of pieces of paper and make that your nomination paper. So you need, I think it's 200 for the Assembly, for example, and 400 for the Senate. You would just have stacks of paper that you turn into the Elections Commission to qualify for the ballot.
Now that seems a lot more cumbersome to get through the process.
Yeah, a lot more work. It's going to be interesting, but really, you know, for a lot of these races, it's all about the presidency. And I mean, I don't want to diminish the work, the fundraising, the things that these candidates are going to be doing between now and November 3rd. But President Trump sucks up so much oxygen. I mean, a president race does anyway, but Trump is such a unique figure in politics that I don't know how these candidates are going to break through that noise. The presidential race this fall, it's going to be especially difficult.
So for the partisan primary, are you seeing mail in mailboxes? Are there ads being run?
I live on the east side of Madison. I've got a stack of mail pieces next to my desk that I kind of collect to see the messages that candidates are sending out. I am starting to see some digital stuff. What's unique this time around about mail and digital is that usually in a campaign, you kind of time it. So you're kind of peaking right before people go to the polls, right? So that's in mid-August for us this year in Wisconsin for the primary. But with the push for voting by mail, campaigns are having to reconfigure their plans, right? Because I already have an absentee ballot on my desk for state races. If you don't get me mail by now, you might miss me. My wife has already cast her ballot. So you have to start sending mail out earlier than you normally would and start thinking about, okay, who am I targeting and when? Because you can't just save everything you have for like a final 10-day push because you're going to miss people.
So explain, remind us, how will voting options for the August primary be different from the April election that drew so much national attention over in-person voting?
Well, a lot of it's going to be the same, although places like Milwaukee, where they had big problems, are already promising to have more polling places open. But you're not seeing as public a push for people to vote via mail, in part because I think the message is already out there from the spring. If you don't feel comfortable going to a polling place in person, request an absentee ballot. You can go to the state website to request your absentee ballot, and you have the option to click to get one for every race left in 2020. So if you do a one-time shot, get the August ballot plus the November one. I get the impression that election officials are hoping to avoid the last-minute rush that we saw with April. Because remember, go back to April election, the weeks leading up to it. For a number of weeks, Governor Evers and Republican lawmakers are kind of singing from the same hymnal of, hey, we've got a pandemic going on. We can vote by mail. It's easy to request an absentee ballot. It's going to be okay. And then as it got closer and cases started ramping up, the governor started to shift message a little bit, saying, okay, we need to start thinking about going to an all-mail election. He tried to delay the election, a bunch of court fights. There were a lot of late requests for ballots. So that kind of really threw things off. If you go look right now, there have already been more than 700,000 requests for absentee ballots. We are, what, 3-4 weeks out from the election?
3 weeks and
primary.
Change.
Yeah, mm-hmm. 3 weeks out from the primary. They've already got 700,000-plus requested absentee ballots. We had fewer than that people vote in the entire primary in 2016. So the message seems to be out there about get your ballot early, avoid that last-minute rush. Now, the question is going to be, how will counting them go? It's a little bit different process with an absentee ballot. With you vote in person, you know, you take the ballot yourself, feed the machine, walk out the door. With absentee ballots, you have the added step of people at the polling sites have to open the envelope, check everything, then feed the machine. I know it sounds not that complicated, but it just slows things down a little bit. So be interesting to watch, you know, how the August primary goes for tallying up the votes. Because in November, if we exceed 3 million, you know, votes again, like we normally do in a presidential race, if we have a significant number of those votes cast via absentee ballot, it could be a longer process than normal to count everything.
Let's bring in a call. Now, George is joining us from Monroe. Hi, George.
Hi. You were just talking about my concern, which is that you cannot have 3 weeks away from the election and the judges are still opening envelopes and trying to figure out if that's a valid vote or not. And to say it's going to be a problem is the understatement of the year. Is the suggestion that the mail ballots will be at the polling place and the normal judges will feed them through the machine? That seemed to what you were being saying a minute ago. But you got a plan. I've got friends in Colorado and Oregon, and they talk about this is it took a tremendous amount of planning and finances to do vote by mail. You know, statewide, which is what they do. And you're not just going to send out the ballots. That's the least of it.
George, thank you for the call. JR, what will this process entail and how long could it take to count these votes?
So right now, the August election is going to be conducted under quote-unquote normal procedures, which is an absentee ballot to be counted has to be at the polling site by 8 p.m. on election night. They are then fed through the machine by the poll workers there in most communities. Now, there are some places like Milwaukee that have called a central count. That means all absentee ballots go to one spot and they count them there. It's not uncommon, but it's not the majority, I think, of the way municipalities do it. So it's a normal procedure. what Carl referred to, like, well, the judges kind of lead me to thought about the legal procedures we have going on right now. So that's how August is going to work. Normal. We'll see how it goes. A dry run. I mean, we should have smaller turnout than we will in November. But with the judges aspect, we have about four or five federal lawsuits combined into one right now that are pending in the Western District of Wisconsin that are seeking a number of changes to the November election. So I think in talking to people, part of the confusion over April was just the whiplash of court decisions. We had the Thursday before the April election, a federal judge in Madison changed some rules. The next day, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals embraced part of it, but changed part of his decision. On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court stepped in and said, no, we're not doing this piece of it. We had the governor try and push back the election, but the state Supreme Court stepped in and said, no, you can't do that. The judge in these cases combined into one in Madison has said he doesn't want to have a last minute, like, you know, craziness. He wants to get this thing decided in plenty of time, the Elections Commission, to make changes and have everything implemented. So we could see some changes yet to how Wisconsin's November election is going to run, including the county of absentee ballots, when they're going to be due. But the message seems to be from that judge, it should be clear earlier how that's going to work, and that might help avoid some of the confusion we saw in April.
We're talking with J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics, on the State Capitol Report, getting your insights on the August primary and what elections will entail in Wisconsin at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Richard now, joining us from Two Rivers. Hi, Richard.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me on the air. I have kind of a simple question. I mean, all those votes have to go through a machine. And it's already been proven that machines have been hacked, either by Russians or whoever. And what steps are they taking to prevent that from happening again?
Richard, thanks for the call, JR.
So the voting machines in Wisconsin, and I can't speak to other states, but in Wisconsin, those machines are not online at the polling site. Okay, so if you were going to hack a machine in Wisconsin at the polling site, it is, you have to do it while poll workers are watching you. I'm not saying it can't be done. I have not heard of it being done in Wisconsin at a polling site. So there is not that online connection with the machines that makes them vulnerable to an issue. But yeah, there are security concerns. There are all kinds of concerns about this election. We are going to be one of the tipping points for the presidential election this fall. So as you can imagine, we will be in the eye of the storm. And if it's a close race in Wisconsin, there's any hint of an issue, I imagine lots of legal fights, lots of lawyers. And we may not be done November 3rd. I mean, it may take longer than normal to count the votes. But if there's any suggestion something went awry with the election and how it was conducted, we could be in the courts for a while trying to figure out what really happened in Wisconsin.
We are with WisPolitics editor J.R. Ross getting a preview of the August 11th partisan primary, looking in particular at some of the contests you're coming up to watch in the run for seats in the state legislature. Are you voting absentee in the primary? Have you received your ballot? What questions do you have about the latest campaign disclosures? What do you want to know about fundraising or spending in state elections? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. We'll be back with more State Cap in a minute here on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have WisPolitics editor J.R. Ross by our side as we get a preview of the August 11th partisan primary, some key primary races that J.R. is keeping tabs on around the state. What candidates do you want to know about? How much campaign mail are you getting? What issues are you hearing candidates talk about in the August primaries? We're at 800-642-1234, and J.R. Ross stays with us for 10 more minutes. Jared, let's look at some of these races, starting in Madison. Half of the state Senate seats are up for election this fall. One of the most competitive primaries may be District 26 in Madison, the seat held by retiring Senator Fred Risser. Seven Democrats are on the ballot. What do you see in this race?
It's wide open, but in talking to people around Madison, insiders, that the general feeling is that Kelda Roy starts with a little bit of an advantage because she's a former member of the assembly. She ran for governor. She raised the most amount of cash in the most recent reporting period. And I know people hate money in politics, but money allows you to amplify your message, to reach voters via mail, via digital ads, via radio. It's just an advantage. And so the fact that she's raised the most, she's been on the ballot before, that might give her somewhat of an edge. But when you're talking about a field that wide, it's hard to say. I'm not going to predict anybody who's going to win that race. I would never do that. But it's just so hard in a seven-person race to say, okay, this person's going to be it because of blank. But I do get the impression that Kilda has somewhat of an inside track.
So Democrats are on the ballot for District 26 seat. No Republicans.
No, part reason because it wouldn't matter if you were a Republican on the ballot. You're not going to win that seat. It is one of the bluest seats in the state, and it's basically a lifetime appointment. And I don't mean that facetiously, but think about Fred Risser. He was in that office for more than 50 years. That's a lifetime for a lot of people. So if you win this seat, and barring a giant demographic change in Madison, it's going to be a Democratic one for a long, long time. As long as you do your homework, are a good steward of the seat, pay attention to voters' concerns, you can stay there for a long time. And it's also going to be a springboard to other things if you play cards right.
Well, you alluded to this earlier. The new campaign fundraising reports came out last week. What did you learn about the amount of cash flowing into candidates or the parties ahead of the fall election season?
The State Democratic Party of Wisconsin is doing a phenomenal job raising money, unlike anything I've ever seen. And really what the party's doing is taking the playbook written by Republicans and perfecting it. If you go back to 2015, Republicans rewrote the campaign finance laws in Wisconsin to have in place a system where there are no limits on contributions to political parties, which can then make unlimited transfers to state candidates. Well, when Republicans were in charge of the Capitol and had Governor Walker in the East Wing, they did a great job attracting big checks, in part because Walker was a phenomenal fundraiser. They could use that to run their campaigns. Well, now the shoe's on the other foot, where you have Tony Evers in the East Wing. You have a state chair in Ben Wickler who has great national connections from his work with MoveOn.org. You also have this perfect storm of those things, plus we're a tipping point in Wisconsin in the national presidential race, plus a lot of liberal, progressive, Democratic donors who are quite frankly afraid of the idea of a second-term President Trump, and they're willing to give in large amounts. You add it all up, and they're just knocking the ballpark. They raised $10 million in a three-month period, which is something I've never seen before, and part of it was big checks. I mean, I'm used to seeing the Republican Party do that, but now the Democrats are doing it. And Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, he gave just shy of $2.5 million by himself to the State Democratic Party to help fuel that fundraising. And what's happening is the party's doing so well that money is filtering down to other candidates and committees. So,
because there's enough money to spread it around?
Yep, absolutely. So I'm used to seeing, for example, the four caucuses in the Capitol, they each have their own campaign committee. Republicans are in power. Money flows to power. So the Republican campaign committees have always, well, the last decade, raised more money than Democrats. In this last period, for example, the Senate Democrats were just off, I think, like $3,000 or $4,000 from what Republicans raised, in part because the State Democratic Party gave them a transfer of six figures. It helps level the playing field. Now, what I'm watching for going forward is how much more flows into the state party. How can they spread that money around? And there's always a balancing act of, okay, the ultimate goal in Wisconsin is for Joe Biden to win the state because that would really hurt President Trump in his reelection bid. But how else do they use that money to help legislative candidates? Again, can help level the playing field and make a real difference in some places that, because the big thing right now is, can Republicans get to a two-thirds majority in both houses? They need to net three seats in each house to override Governor Evers' vetoes without Democratic votes. It's within reach. But if the president continues to struggle the way he has and Democrats keep pulling this money in, it makes it really tough to get to that two-thirds majority in both houses.
If you're just joining us, our guide is WisPolitics editor J.R. Ross on the State Capitol Report. We're previewing the August primary, the November general, and seeing what you think about the races. Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Tom now in Cedarburg this morning. Hi, Tom.
Morning. I'm wondering, for Sensenbrenner's seat, whoever wins on August 11th, will they be seated in his seat, or will that be finalized in November?
It'll be finalized in November. So the Republican primary is Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald and a businessman, Cliff DeTemple. It's a very Republican seat, but there's a Democrat on the ballot as well in November, so that seat won't be filled until the November election, and it'll be seated in January. Fitzgerald is, I think, favored from talking to people. He's raised the most money. It's a very Republican seat. If he wins, it'll be interesting because he'd have to resign the Senate seat, and there'll be a new majority leader in the Senate, assuming Republicans remain control of that chamber after November, and it's going to have a domino effect what's going to happen in the state capitol next session.
Well, let's take a look at suburban Milwaukee here. Five Republicans are on the ballot for District 28, which covers southwestern suburbs of Milwaukee. And this is that open seat because Senator Dave Craig isn't seeking reelection. What do you note about this race?
Well, looking at the finance numbers, Dan Griffin is running that race. He gave himself $30,000, accounting for half of the $60,000 that he raised. Julian Bradley, he's running. He is somebody who actually ran for the legislature from Western Wisconsin a few years back, ran for Secretary of State in 2014, I think it was, and lost. He relocated to Southeastern Wisconsin for work, and now he's running for the state Senate from there.
As a Republican.
Yep. Yep. Okay. Long-time Republican activist. So it's a crowded primary. It's in the Milwaukee market. It's hard to get up on TV because it's expensive. Radio is an option, digital ads and mail. So I'm watching there to see kind of how that plays out. Also, in Milwaukee, in Republican politics, talk radio plays a huge role. So if any of these candidates can really catch fire with the talk radio crowd, that's a big deal. Those guys drive turnout, especially in primaries, and it can be a huge booster if you get those guys like the Jay Webbers, the Dan O'Donnell, the Mark Belling, those guys on your, Vicki McKenna, get those folks behind you, it'd be huge.
Really quickly, moving to La Crosse, vacant after Senator Jennifer Schilling left and became a lobbyist. Three Democrats running for the seat, including Brad Paff, who Republicans rejected as the agriculture secretary. What are you watching in this race?
Really, Brad Paff is favored. He got a huge transfer from state Democrats to help boost his fundraising number. He's really the attention's on him for the general election. Now, what's really interesting is Dan Kopanky is a Republican. He actually won that seat in 04 and 08, lost it in a recall in 11, Jennifer Schilling, ran against Schilling again in 16, lost by 61 votes. So this seat can be close. Here's the rub, though. That seat was close in 2016 in part because Hillary Clinton did so poorly in that district. Normally, a Democrat at the top of the ticket does like in the mid-50s, you know, 53-57%, somewhere that range. Clinton was nowhere near that. It helped allow Kopanky to be close. What I'm watching is how does the Trump-Biden race shape up? If Trump does really well in Western Wisconsin again and is close in that Senate district for the presidential race, Kopanky has a shot. If Biden, however, returns to a normal number for Democrat, you know, that mid-50s, that's a huge mountain to climb, in part because it's tough for legislative candidates generally to break through the top of ticket noise. This year may be even tougher because of Trump and just how dominant a figure he is in politics.
Well, JR, thank you for joining us.
Anytime. Have a great day.
You too. JR Ross, editor of WisPolitics. We've been talking about the upcoming elections. What do you want to say about this year's elections? Leave us a voicemail anytime, 833-424-3327. That's 833-424-3327. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.